Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 4. Now, we're talking about your time at RF College Cranwell. We talked about how you got on with the cadets above and below, above you, rather. How did you get on with the cadets of your year? You know, what sort of background were they like? What were the same sort of lad as yourself? What were they like?
The oldest one I've kept in touch with is a great friend, and he was Fred Daly, and he was actually came from a seminary, and he left the seminary because he decided it wasn't for him. He was a good rugby player, and that sometimes went, I think, with the sort of Catholic school upbringing. And he was actually transferred from Jerby, from his sort of officer training there. So he'd already started. And then we had two people, one from Halton, because that often used to happen, that the top bloke at Halton would have the option of going to Cranwell if he wanted to do it. Now, it was amazing, really, because Gordon Talbot was in that in my entry. He came from Halton, and then we had someone from Locking. His name was Jock McVie, and he also, having done his training, his boys' apprentice training, was far more worldly wise in terms of what went on in the service, obviously, than we were. And he was on my squadron in my hut. And it was interesting how his sort of service knowledge, how important that was in the first sort of few weeks.
How did you feel get on with them? You know, did you like them?
I was slightly surprised, and it might sound a bit priggish, but I was amazed that there were two people in the entry. Intriguingly, they were both Scots guys. One sadly was killed in the helicopter, and whether it was their accent or whether it was their character or whether it was a combination of both, but almost all the entries seemed to take almost an animal, strangely, a slight dislike to these two guys, and one ended up an air marshal. I mean, it was quite intriguing, really. And the rest of the entry all thought, well, we put him straight to some extent. But all I'm saying is a clan of people, I suppose. I found that rather strange, that in a way that they were tending to sort of, I suppose, naturally that people go together. But I tried to overcompensate the other way around for these two people, because whether it was linked with my sort of altruistic mother or what, I don't know, but I slightly didn't like that aspect. But one imagines that happens in schools, and I was amazed that it happened in college. But basically they were all volunteers there, and by the time one or two of the guys had fallen out, you know, I think most people did get on very well with each other.
Now, what did you think of the instructors and the methods they used?
In charge of everything was somebody that became an Air Vice Marshal. He was a Wing Commander Powell. And I think his two sons have helped run Britain in both governments, you might know. They were both there as youngsters. I can't really remember them apart from them. But the elder one was Charles, and the younger one is Jonathan. And Jonathan's been tied up with the whole Blair regime since the word go. And Charles was the Foreign Office, selected from the Foreign Office to go to Margaret Thatcher, and was got very close to the whole area of policy. And you've probably heard him, because I think he was made a lord, and intriguingly they're brothers, they're both named Pole, but Charles called himself Pole, and Jonathan calls himself Powell. Now, but they were both sons of the guy that ran he was the wing commander in charge of all the academic side,
the people who taught you more.
I mean, yeah, well, this wing commander would instruct us on basically geopolitics, I think you would sum it up. I'm trying to think exactly what it was called.
What was he like?
Oh, I thought he was quite a fine bloke. I liked him. I think all the instructors, I can't remember taking a dislike to any of the instructors. But other people notice things, which I often didn't, you know. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm that laid back a person, but
what do you mean?
Some people fussed about things right throughout the service, which never fussed me, and they notice things, and it might be linked with what we've sought, the military life, you know, but I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Did you think the instructors knew their stuff?
Yeah, I'd say most of them. Yep.
And what about things like the drill instructors?
We had
the PT instructors. They behaved. How did they behave?
Yes, I think they just sort of licked you into shape, and I think probably there's nothing wrong with that. It never fussed me, even when one got into trouble with it all. You know, and you could say some of that might have been a bit ridiculous thinking back with the way things are done now, but I don't think it ever fussed me too much.
What was discipline like? I mean, did you run into disciplinary trouble? You know, did you have any problems, or were you put in a charge?
Well, I probably had my fair share, if not more, on the restrictions side.
What sort of things would you do wrong?
Well, if you were back late, for instance, you know, I had a motorbike, and if you had problems with your bike and you got back after hours, you know, you could end up very quickly being on what they called strikers, which was restrictions, which was punishment, basically, and it was extra parades, and your standard of kit had to be more up to standard, sort of more perfect than normal, and also because you had more parades, you had to be more involved with blankoing your kit and sort of bullying your boots and things like that. I can remember, you know, even experimenting and being in problems with bullying one's boots, because, I mean, there were various shortcuts, which you probably also know about, like putting nail varnish on it, and it would work very well, and then, you know, if they got too hot, the whole thing would you'd have problems with it. I mean, that aspect, I must say, I did find, you know, almost excessive, but, you know, we used to have to burn the toe caps of the ammunition type boots that we had, the standard boots for drill, and you would skate about a bit, particularly in the college, because the college now has got carpets in it, but in those days, you know, it's kind of stone, and you could skate along on the back of your studs. And my big memories were going up the cinder path on the left, on the west side of the college, very early in the morning, still in the darkness, for the punishment parades. And that's a very vivid memory. The crunch as you went up the cinder path, they ended up covering that, and you can hardly see it now. There's a row of trees there where it was the edge of the what's called the orange, and you even have the punishment parades in front of the college. That was when you actually finished your first 6 months, because at the end of your first 6 months and after, then you'd start your flying.
Now, was there a passing out parade or something at the end of the first 6 months? Or was that right at the end of the course?
No, you're right. It was more routine parades, because your parades too would be assessed in a way. There were about the standard of drill. That would be, again, an inter-squadron thing. So you'd have an involvement right the way up for all your entries in a squadron way on how your squadron had performed in drill, and you also had the competitions there as well as sport. So sport and drill you'd be doing in a squadron way, and yet the activities you'd be doing in as an individual.
Now, what comes first, survival training or flying training?
Well, survival camp was your last rite of passage before you learned to fly.
Tell me about the survival camp and the survival training.
Well, that was up in Wales, and I can remember thoroughly enjoying that. And it didn't fuss me, you know, if I was wet and having been used to camping before. But I think one or two people, it was probably quite surprising.
Now, what was survival training? What were they training you to do?
Well, live in the mountains and also map read and also, to some extent, survival techniques. But at a slightly... And it was a kind of miniature... Brecon Beacons type thing. Sometimes they went to Brecon Beacons. We went up to Snowdonia, and I can remember we had a race, and I can remember we won the race, even though we had to almost drag someone up to the summit, and we were one stage thinking we'd overcooked it with this chap, and we had a very slight bloke who ended up as a navigator who did remarkably well on that. But I mean, we just had the simple idea of of scouts pacing the early bits. So where it was flat, this race, we scouts paced at double the rate, and then we had this other chap that ended up with the Queen's Medal. So he was quite bright on the academic side, who we literally had to drag up the last bit, but we won that element of the race up Snowdon, because he actually raced up Snowdon. I can remember that.
Any other aspects of Snowdonia, the survival training camp?
Some difficulties with the sort of low cloud, I can remember, and the interesting business of navigating going round. And
now, how did they begin to teach to fly then?
You went down to flights, and you were allocated an instructor who normally you'd stay with, and then depending on whether he was pre-qualified because he'd been an instructor long enough. I can remember mine was sadly he's not too fit now, but I mean he was just like Johnny Weissmuller, and he had a flash A90 car that was vivid white, and not the one that you'd, you know, he's a very, very good looking bloke.
Do you remember his name?
That was Alan Palmer, A.V.E. Palmer, who later I can remember meeting out again at El Adam, because he commanded El Adam later.
So what would he be then, a lieutenant or?
He'd be a flight lieutenant, and...
Now, what was he like as an instructor?
Well, I thought he was approachable, and then I also had I was lucky, really, because I also had a South African called John Grobler, who must have died young, because he was quite South African, and he came to me a little later, but still early on in the Chipmunk, because we were flying the Chipmunk. The apprentices had just left, had finished, although occasionally we'd see an apprentice that would arrive. And we'd be flying from the North Airfield to start with. The North Airfield was just grass. So again, I was fortunate to fly from the grass airfield first, because quite quickly that stopped, I think, after that.
Now, what were the Chipmunk? Who makes the Chipmunk?
That's de Havilland.
Now, what was the de Havilland Chipmunk like?
It had a Gypsy Major engine.
What did you think of that? What was its nature? What was it like as an aircraft? Because people don't know it anymore. I mean, outside of the people who...
Well, it's a remarkably successful aircraft, because they're still treasured to this day. And there must be 60... Knocking on, not quite yet, but, you know... Quite shortly, there will be 60 years of age, and many of them are flying.
And what were their characteristics? What did they look like?
Well, I think it's a very good trainer. It it was a lowish wing that you climbed into, and it was a tandem trainer, so that the instructor would be in the back and the student would be in the front, and I really much preferred tandem trainers. Yeah, I think they had certain advantages, because...
Now, what were the advantages?
Well, when you were learning formation flying, you felt more that you were by yourself in a tandem trainer. Whether or not you were by yourself, if you had an instructor in the back, you still, it felt like a single seat aircraft. And I loved the Gnat as opposed to the Hunter, which I didn't like. I mean, when I learnt that fly the Hunter, we only had the single seat later when you went off solo, and then the trainer came later, and that was side by side, and the Vampire was side by side. But so there was an advantage, I felt, in the tandem seating arrangement, because you felt more like you were flying the aircraft by yourself, even though to start with, obviously, you'd have your instructor there for the duel, and you'd roughly, probably a third of your flying would be duel, or maybe a little more.
Now, what was a dual flying instruction like? How did they start you? You know, you're doing your dual flying.
Well, to start with, it's sort of very much a fixed aspect. They call it effects of controls, which I always think is a rather overblown description. But Central Flying School always used that, and to this day, you're taking up, well, the first sortie is an enjoyment sortie, really, that you're not doing too much, and it's just called familiarisation normally, almost with any aircraft, so that you enjoy it as much as anything. And then effects of controls, they just take you up, and literally they show you, you know, the very important thing is the horizon. So you go up where you've got a horizon, and you learn that when you're going very fast, your nose will be lower on the horizon, and then you've got to keep it on the horizon as you're doing a turn, otherwise you slip down. So you learn to fly straight and level to start with, and then you learn turning, and then you learn steep turning.
What is the art of turning?
And then, well, it's a coordination. We were very lucky, because we started with the Chipmunk, and what I didn't mention, that of course was a piston trainer, and our course was extremely fortunate, because we went from piston Chipmunk, de Havilland Chipmunk, onto the next stage, still in a basic flying, and we converted into the Provost, which was a piston Provost. I mean, everyone calls it the piston Provost now, but I mean, it was just the Provost then, because the jet Provost hadn't been invented. And then we went on to the Balliol, which was just like a sort of two-seat side-by-side Spitfire, and then the Vampire. So we were very lucky that we had four types to wings, which is most unusual.
So what's the art of turning in a piston engine Chipmunk then?
Well, it's a question of getting the right power, and also the balance, so that you're not in a steep turn, that you're maintaining a level turn, and you're not going up or down, and cross-referring with your instruments and the horizon outside. And then it's obviously an important aspect to cover that all in the clear weather before you actually do it all on instruments, because you probably know that in your ear you've got little crystals and also liquid flowing around, the two aspects where if you're in a cloud they can completely confuse you as to which way up and which way down is, with the acceleration of in an aircraft, and you don't know which way up you are in cloud. And one of the very early things you've got to learn in instrument flying is not to trust your own senses. You've got to trust the instruments regardless.
So you started instrument flying right at the beginning, did you?
Quite early on, yeah. And the Air Force always had this advantage of its six master instruments. The idea was that virtually every aircraft would have the standard six instruments.
And what are they?
You have your
if you can remember
airspeed, your airspeed indicator, which is just telling you how fast you are, and you obviously already learned that your airspeed low down and your airspeed up, if you're very high, you'll have a low airspeed but a very high true airspeed. And then your other instruments, you've got the artificial horizon and then the directional gyro, and your compass down below, and your direction gyro is just your direction indicator or your DI. And then you have your turn and slip indicator, and then your, what was called to start with, we called it a vertical speed indicator. That was whether you're going up or whether you're going down and by what rate. And then that changed its name to the rate of climb and descent indicator, an RCDI. And those were your six master instruments.
Now, so you do the effective controls. I suspect the instrument flying, you start quite soon, but not whatever.
Oh, no, but so probably a little later.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. But it's while you're doing dual,
gradually.
So that's all right. We don't have to get everything exactly in order. So effective controls is early days. What's the next thing?
Well, climbing and descending, and then gliding, and then very early on you're already learning how to fly a circuit, which is the important thing, and taking off and taxiing. I mean, the very first thing you learn on probably your very first sortie, they'd just be introducing you to how to taxi, and it with chipmunk, you had to put your brake you had to put your brake on to some extent, and that you had to be careful to get the brake set at a certain thing, because you'd actually control that with your rudders. It's a slightly unusual aspect of the chipmunk, and if you had too much of it, you could tip on your nose, obviously, with it, and you'd have to weave you'd be learning to weave, and so that you could see ahead because of the engine, and the being a tailwheel. It was a tailwheel aircraft, and even more so with the piston provost. And then when we went on to the Balliols, we were very lucky to see the last of the advanced pistons with the Merlin engine. You really had to snake down the taxi track, otherwise you're completely blind ahead because of the very big engine.
So taxi. Now, what about takeoff? What was there to learn about takeoff? I presume you'd have to learn that first.
Yes, and really, it sounds a bit strange, but a piston was far more difficult to take off, and in a way it was a far better trainer, because I can remember later as an instructor on the Jet Provost that there we were, the Royal Air Force, ahead of the rest of the world, having a jet trainer, but it's far easier to take a jet off than it is a piston.
And why is it difficult to take a piston engine? What's the problem?
Well, it's really with the torque of the propeller. The propeller's a really big disc flying around, and it's just like a flywheel or a gyroscopic effect. And once you rotate the aircraft, you'll know there's such a thing called precession, and you've got the torque of the engine, which has got a reaction on your, even down to your oleos and what have you, the other way round. And as you put all your power on, there's a tendency to swing, and you've got to check that with your rudder, and it's the coordination of that rudder on takeoff, depending on the torque. And the bigger, the stronger the engine, the more you're likely are to have what's called a ground loop, where you completely lose control, and that not irregularly happened with Harvards, and also occasionally even on chipmunks.
So basically the engine
could lose control.
It would pull you to the right.
That's
or left.
Right.
Well, right, I presume.
That's right, with a torque. And then when you rotated the aircraft, so when you put your tail up, because you all of those were tailwheel aircraft, as you accelerated, you had to get onto your main wheels and lift your tail. And as you did that, effectively, you were changing a rapidly rotating disc with a gyroscopic effect, which was also adding to your problems, so to speak. And again, that was a question of getting used to that handling on takeoff. And at night, you had to be even more careful because, you know, you always had to establish a rate of climb. And in that marvelous book by Geoffrey Wellham, First Light, you know, he describes very well going off at night, and then his great friend just, he actually saw him killed at night because he'd forgotten to uncage his direction indicator. So he'd gone down the runway and he'd got airborne, and he just gradually wandered off and just went straight in.
So you had to maintain your rate
of climb. Oh, your rate of climb, yeah. You always had to make certain that you were climbing at night because you'd no way of knowing that you were up, going up or going down without your instrument.
So taking off, landing springs to mind as the next thing. I presume they taught you fairly quickly.
Yes, and your circuit work, you're right.
Circuit
so
work.
That's right. And normally you'd be doing a left-hand circuit, but again, from that, what we were saying about the signal square, there'd be certain circuits where you'd be doing a right-hand circuit. But again, we were extremely fortunate because we saw the end of the grass airfield in a way, because that was coming to an end, really, that very quickly after that one was using runways.
Now, what about landings? What are the skills you need in landing a chipmunk?
Well, it's really getting used to what a correct approach was. And in those days, you would start with a square circuit, a rectangular circuit. So you would get airborne, you'd climb ahead, and you'd climb to probably, I think, 300 or 400 feet. And then you'd start a climbing turn if you're staying in the circuit and turn onto your downwind leg where you'd have the wind behind you. And then you'd carry out your downwind checks. I mean, first of all, you'd have your after takeoff checks on the climb, and then you'd climb crosswind and then downwind, and then your important downwind checks, making certain with your chipmunk you always had your undercarriage down, but that would be your most important check on all other aircraft if you had an undercarriage. And you'd have your settings and your vital actions when you went downwind. And then we would, as I say, you do a rectangular circuit, so you'd turn crosswind and you'd be already losing height. And it was a question of judging on the variability of the wind, because that affected you much more, again, on a slow aircraft. So, and being able to land in crosswinds and short landing techniques, and you'd have to learn all those. And also, what was great fun in the chipmunk was learning to side slip, because if you were too high, you could, it felt weird, but you were cross-controlled. You could actually side-slip down and lose a lot of height quite quickly, something that you couldn't really do easily in later aircraft at all.
Did you find judging the landing difficult, you know, the actual, when you actually flatten out?
Well, I think that was one of the problems. I mean, as I said, Chris Bonington, sadly, was completely unable to sort out the final approach and that. And he'd done it, I can remember, he learned it rather mechanically, you see, from little things around the airfield that he would take as cues. But when he was on his final, what was called a chop check, when he was, you know, either stay or go, he was taken off to another airfield to do it, and that completely sort of threw him. And sadly, you know, I can remember being very prescient, because I said it's far better to go off and do something you're good at rather than be second rate in the Air Force. And I hadn't realised he'd end up going to the top of his profession on mountaineering, climbing.
Now, what about you? What, did you have any trouble with landing, judging the landing?
I think it was just something I gradually picked up, you know, with an instructor. I can remember frightening him a bit on the when I went solo on the Balliol, because, I mean, often instructors used to try and get their students off first. You know, it's a kind of thing that instructors sometimes did. And
but what about the chipmunk landings? No problems?
I think it was just something one gradually learned. I was very pleased. You know, I thought the instructors were really, really very good.